listening to Cannabis Health Radio. Here are your hosts, Ian Jessup and Corey Yelland.
Welcome to another episode of Cannabis Health Radio. I'm Ian Jessup.
And I'm Corey Yelland.
Before we get to our guest today, I want to say thank you to all the people around the world who listen to our podcasts. And Corey, our audience is growing weekly, and that's good news. And we'd like to thank people. And if you'd like to thank us, you can go to our Facebook page and like us. Same with Twitter. And also, one of the things we don't talk about much, Corey, is iTunes.
Right.
And if people go to iTunes and give us a 5-star rating, we'll go up in the pecking order.
And we want to be top pecker.
We want to be top Speak for yourself.
Oh, Ian, I know you do.
Yes. And how else can people thank us, Corey?
Well, you know, you can always go to cannabishealthradio.com and make a contribution there. And if you can keep us up and running, that would be awesome.
Now let's get to our guest. In 2004, our guest today had what doctors described as a significant stroke, and her family was told that she would likely wouldn't live. But if she did, she would be institutionalized for the rest of her life. Of course, that didn't happen. Joining us today to tell her remarkable story of recovery is Ellen Durkee from Nova Scotia, Canada. Ellen, thank you very much for doing this.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
For someone who is supposed to be institutionalized, you have made just a remarkable, dramatic recovery. Now, when you had your aneurysm in 2004, followed by your significant stroke, what do you remember about it?
I remember the Queen being in a room down the hall and her guards walking up and down and keeping me awake. Isn't that crazy? But I actually remember it like it was real. And I would tell people, the Queen is driving me crazy. They're keeping me awake.
That is so bizarre.
Yeah, I don't remember a lot. I remember, you know, seconds of things and sounds. I remember a few sounds and some smells, but I don't really remember much.
Were there any symptoms that you had prior to your aneurysm that you look back at now and think, oh, okay, maybe that was the start of it?
I've been having migraines for probably 15 years or so before this happened, and they say they don't know if that's related to it or not. They don't expect so because the migraines didn't stop afterwards. The day that it happened, I took my daughter to a basketball game, so I was at the high school. By chance, I happened to be an emergency medical responder with the local fire department, and I was on call that day, so I had my radio with me. And apparently, I passed out. I don't remember passing out, but I passed out in my seat and woke up, and there was a nurse, a friend, who was with me, and they had called an ambulance. And because it was just a fainting, they thought it wasn't a lights and sirens call, so there was no big rush to get there. So I got on my emergency radio and called my captain, and they sent the emergency squad. So it was quite a thing for the fire department that, you know, one of their members had their own called themselves in. And from there to the hospital. And I don't remember the ambulance fellas getting there. I remember calling it in, and then that's it for about a month and a half. I slept completely through Hurricane Juan, if you remember that. Mm-hmm. Woke up to, I guess there were a few snowdrifts left, but I missed the worst of that.
Ellen, when you called in, were you aware that something was really wrong?
I had an idea, just only because I didn't remember passing out, and I was in a different room. They had taken me into the weight room where they have mats on the floor and had me lay down. And for some reason, I had brought my radio with me. And I thought, something's not right, and I really should have, you know, somebody here as quick as possible. So I called my team, and they were, probably 3 minutes, and the first of them arrived.
Just for clarification, was that your aneurysm or was that your stroke?
That was the aneurysm.
That was the aneurysm. When did the stroke happen?
It was 10 days later. It was my first day actually out of bed. And until that point, I had been tied in bed because I was pretty aggressive, I think, with people. And I wanted to escape, of course. And I really was a bit of a loopy nutcase. And so they had me sitting in my chair. They didn't have me tied in, and I was left in the room alone. My mother had just left and had told the nurse that she was leaving. And the nurse said, okay. And the nurse actually was in the room at the time. And then the nurse left. I was alone. I apparently stood up to go to the bathroom and fell down. And within 3 hours, had a stroke.
Do you remember being aggressive?
No. No, not at all.
Mm. Now, what did the stroke do to your right eye?
They call it blowing the pupil, and it's the black center part of my eye went right out to the white, so it was kind of, my eye looked a little bit wonky. It didn't affect my vision that much, but it did affect the way my eyes work. When you read, your eyes kind of cross. They both move towards the center, and I couldn't do that. I was probably about 6 months of eye exercises to be able to focus in to read for more than 3 or 4 minutes before I would get a horrible headache.
That must have been a pretty scary time for you.
No, strangely enough, no. It wasn't. It wasn't. And the doctors at the hospital, after they give you all these neurological tests to see what you've lost, what you've retained, and all that kind of stuff. And other than my math, I can't add, subtract. I can do very simple, like a make change. But on multiplication looks like a completely different language to me. I just don't understand how that works. No, nothing really was scary except for the fact that I was, almost trapped. I didn't like the fact that I couldn't get up and go by myself.
See, I'd find that really frightening myself. So you're a better person. You're a better person than I.
I don't know. I think the doctor had asked after, this would have been months later, he said, what do you attribute your recovery? Because, 3% of people actually live through it. Very, very few people actually come back. And, most of the people I was in the hospital with ended up being angry or depressed or all of that stuff. And I said, the only thing I can think of is I could not imagine not getting better. So it never entered my mind that I wouldn't. Mm-hmm. And I think that's pretty big.
Yeah, a very positive attitude then.
Positive or just stupid? I don't.
A bit of both.
It's really mind over matter, isn't it?
Kind of. And when I got home, my husband had bought me a computer. When I was coming home, I had an old beat up thing that would take 4 hours to kind of get online, and they decided that a computer, because I was going to be stuck. I didn't have a driver's license because I'd had so many seizures and all that kind of stuff. So they had a new computer waiting for me, and I got on, and my husband had found a web address for a neurological website. And I got on that. They had chat rooms with, every possible neurological condition that you can imagine. No one was ever in the stroke and aneurysm room, but I found a wonderful group of people in the Tourette's chat room. And so I think following 5 and 6 conversations at one time and having to keep them straight in my head really did help with the thinking part, at least, of recovering.
Interesting.
What's so remarkable from my perspective in this is that the doctor said you likely wouldn't live, and if you did, you would be institutionalized for the rest of your life.
Yeah, there was a lot of damage, apparently, of the right part of the brain where this was. I should have lost my language. I should have lost cognition of a lot of things. The tests that they were giving me, they kept repeating these different kinds of word tests. They'd read a line of poetry, I think that I shall never see, a poem, that kind of stuff, and ask me to finish it. And I was able to do it. I probably couldn't do it today, but for some reason when I was getting the test, and they really were surprised. One fellow said, a neuropsychologist said, what do you do for a living? And I said, I'm a custodian at a university. And he goes, maybe you should go to university, which I did.
Oh, you did?
The next year, I went back to school. Yep.
And you said that the doctor told you that only 3% of people who had what you had live through it.
Live or are able to function normally afterwards because of the where it depends on where the aneurysm is and how strong it is. And it's a very, very low number of people that actually live through it.
Ellen, take us through what recovery was like for you in hospital.
Boring. It was in the hospital was like normally like what you'd be in a hospital. You get your meals a few times a day, and you have a few people visit. And then when I was moved over to rehab, I spent a lot of time doing tests, not really learning how to walk. I could walk, but I wasn't steady, and my toes would kind of, I'd lift my foot up, but my toe would stay down, so I would trip a lot. So I kind of had to learn, you know, how to move my body. I had to practice and practice with my left arm. I still am a little bit clumsy with my, I'll carry my keys around for an hour looking for them, and they'll be in my left hand, and I just don't register that they're there. Learning to turn my head when someone was sitting on my left-hand side. If two people would visit, I would remember the person that stood on the right-hand side of the bed. I wouldn't remember the person that stood on the left. So just little tricks to keep your life normal, I guess.
Yeah. And you said in the notes you sent us, you had to learn to walk again.
Learn how to move my feet. Yeah. I could stand and I could move my legs, but I certainly was not graceful. I was in a wheelchair probably for about maybe a month at the hospital, and that was just too slow for me. And I kept going in circles because I couldn't move my left hand. Or I could move it, but I wasn't moving it properly. So I'd, you know, start driving with my right hand and just go in circles because my left hand wasn't working.
You know, listening to you, it strikes me is that you have such a positive attitude that this wasn't going to beat you. You were going to overcome any disability that you had. And I think your attitude was absolutely astounding. Like the doctor, like you said to the doctor, you attributed that to, this isn't going to impact my life in a negative way.
I just couldn't imagine not being myself. Yeah. Although I have to say, and everyone else says, I'm really not the same person that I was beforehand. But strangely enough, I wouldn't change it. I wouldn't have it not happen, other than the fact that, you know, my kids were, you know, were teenagers, and it was certainly difficult for them and for my husband. But as far as me, I didn't really, other than a bit of frustration, didn't go through that bad of a time. There were certainly people there that had bigger life changes and, you know, impacts on them than I did, I think.
Has it changed your perspective of life?
Certainly has. And there was no, you know, there was no big flash of light and like, oh my God, you know, life is wonderful. It was none of that. But suddenly, you know how they say, you know, suddenly things seem more important.
Mm-hmm.
And it's strange. I would notice stuff. I remember distinctly going out the first time I went out by myself out to my flower garden and seeing the bugs on the flowers before I saw the flowers. And just little funny little things like that. Seeing babies, seeing people. I loved people. I would, you know, meet somebody and I would automatically see the good in them. And people would say, you're shining, you know, you're glowing. You know, you just seem happy. And I think that I was.
Maybe that's the way all of us are supposed to be, Ellen.
I don't know. It would be wonderful. But, and I learned, it was strange, probably the biggest thing I learned about myself was that I had been afraid of disabled people. I'd worked at a summer camp when I was a kid with kids with different disabilities. And so I, you know, had been around disabled people before, and I had a cousin who was in a wheelchair for her life. But I'd always been a little bit nervous and would never walk up to someone and introduce myself to them if they were in a wheelchair. But after being in a wheelchair and being in a place where you're surrounded by people in wheelchairs, you suddenly realize, like, hey, they're absolutely no more, you know, no less than we are, and certainly interesting. That was a positive thing that came out of it.
Ellen, we had an inquiry on our Facebook page today from an individual who wanted to know if cannabis could help with strokes.
Absolutely.
And I said, we are not clinicians, but we are doing an interview with a woman who had a stroke, and I suggested that she listen to this interview. Now, tell me how you came upon cannabis.
That would have been in about 2010. I was searching through Facebook, probably, and came upon Rick Simpson's video, Run from the Cure. And I watched it, and then I watched it again, and then I watched it again, and I thought, there's something to this, and started researching like mad, and I came across Corey and Janet Sweeney and a few other people online and listened and watched, and then found MUM, the Maritimers Unite for Medical Marijuana here in Nova Scotia, and met the wonderful people that run that. Found out how I could get my license, got my license, and began. And it was more of a kind of an experiment with me. There wasn't that much talk from anybody about migraine treatments or what it could do to rebuild brains and that kind of thing. At that time, most of the focus seemed to be on cancer. And so I really had to do a lot of extra digging. And I thought, I can experiment on myself. That'll be okay. I wasn't a smoker. I think when I was probably 16, I might have smoked once or twice and then never did again until now. Things you don't expect to be doing when you're 56 years old.
So when you first got the cannabis, did you just smoke it, or were you doing it in the form of a tincture, or what exactly did you do?
No, I started right off with the oil. And just started very, very, very slowly. Made the mistake. I think maybe the third time I took it, I thought, I can up this dose. Well, that was a mistake. But and it wasn't bad. It was just a silly thing to do. So it was just a drop. It was almost like what someone would take on a maintenance dose, just barely any at all. And my migraines stopped. Things I wasn't expecting to have happen. I have IBS, and that pretty much disappeared, so I didn't have that anymore. My arthritis, which really flared up maybe 6 months or so before I started on the oil, didn't go away, but it was, I could feel it, but it was only just feeling. It was like, that's acting up today, but it doesn't hurt. I can just feel it. So there were a lot of little things. My fingernails started growing like mad. My hair started growing like crazy. That, it was all positives except for the fact that now I had to source or grow my own marijuana.
Right. How often were you taking it, Ellen?
Every night before I went to bed. It was just, I think a few times I did take it twice a day, but I could feel it, and I don't like the feeling of being stoned, especially when I'm around the house. So I just was taking it at night. So eventually I got my dose up to, I don't know, probably three times, four times what I started with. It still isn't very much.
But it works for you at that dose.
But it works for me at that dose, or it seems to. It may work better if I took more. It's just that I haven't bothered taking more because I'm satisfied with what that does.
Are you
ahead.
I was just going to ask you, are you doing high THC, or have you got any CBD thrown in there?
It's fairly high THC. The very first that I started using was something that someone had around for about 20 years. They'd been growing the same plant. They called it Swamp Donkey. And sadly, last year, the person that had it went on holiday and left someone else to look after his seed crop, and they all died.
We can't,
and that was the best that I've ever used for my problem anyway. So I've experimented, and I've got two or three strains that I mix together, so it's not just the one strain. And I find that works better too than just having one. You get all those different terpenes and different amounts of THC and CBD. So,
Ellen, when you mentioned your migraines, were you experiencing migraines after your stroke?
Yeah, and in fact, were coming more often. They weren't any stronger, but they're the kind that I have. It's not chronic. I can't remember what the type is called that I have, but they last for 3-4 days. I'm sick to my stomach. I can't see. I can't really drive. I'll have trouble speaking. It's almost like you're having a stroke at some points. You don't want light. It's, the typical migraine with that kind of stuff. And you can't think straight. Everything's just a little bit, just not right.
So you're like a politician.
Kind of.
When you had your migraines and they were as debilitating as you mentioned, did you ever fear that maybe you were getting another stroke?
I did for probably the first year or two. And I go back every so often. For the first 5 years, I was back every year for an angiogram. And the coils that they had put in, they seemed to be fine. I do have another aneurysm on the same spot on the other side of my skull, or other side of my brain, but it hasn't changed. It's the same size that it was back in 2004, so they're not worried about it. The coils have shifted in the one they repaired, and I asked the doctor, so what does that mean? And he said, well, if you have a choice, we can go in and repair it, with more coils, we can do a surgery and clip it, or we can leave it alone. And I said, we'll leave it alone. And they sent my information to specialists and clinics all around the world looking for someone else that had had this or was having the same reaction. But they've only been doing this since probably about 1999, 2000. So they don't know what the long-term things are as far as the coiling and that kind of stuff goes. So we wait and see. But I don't worry about it anymore. I worry about something happening and not dying, as crazy as that sounds. I don't want to be sitting in a wheelchair drooling into my lap and having someone have to tend to my needs.
Ellen, what are these coils you refer to?
They're little tiny threads of titanium, and they're like the spring inside of a ballpoint pen, and they put those inside. They go up through an artery and insert them into the aneurysm, and they just fill it up, and they, over a period of time, they'll kind of heal into the artery and keep it from exploding.
Well, how do you think you would be today if you weren't taking cannabis?
When the migraines are bad, it seems to be usually spring and fall when we have the really quick up and downs with weather and, you know, pressure systems and stuff like that, I really don't function well at all.
It's the barometric pressure that causes them.
That seems to be the main cause. Now, there may be other things. There may be hormonal sometimes, too. I get them so often that I've kept diaries of food and all that kind of stuff, but we can't really pin it down to anything at all. But, I can't plan things. I can't say, yes, I'll be there next Tuesday, or yes, I'll look after the grandchildren on the weekend. You know, I can't do that. So I'm just sort of, you know, day to day. If I'm good when I wake up, then I can do something. If I'm not, then I can't. It's a disability in a way, but it's a different, it's one of those neurological things. You can't see it, so no one else can see it.
Well, you have an extremely positive attitude for someone who has these issues. I know migraines are just a horrible thing to experience. In talking to people who have migraines, they're just, I mean, you just want to lock yourself in a dark room and hear no noise and just be quiet for as long as it takes for the migraine to dissipate.
Yeah. Yeah, if your house was to catch on fire, it would be okay if it was quick. Nothing else can enter that when it's really bad. The rest of the world doesn't really exist. It's kind of just you trying to breathe through the headaches, and for 4 days, it's tiring. You get a little bit frustrated and tired.
Besides taking the oil, do you ever smoke at all, or take edibles or tinctures?
I've tried edibles. I was down to the cannabis cup and to the emerald cup, and I did try a couple of things at those. And they're okay, but they don't work as quickly. It takes about an hour or a little bit better for an edible to work. I find the oil works a little bit faster. Smoking I don't like to do just because I don't like the smell in the house. But since last November, I've had to smoke because I was running low on material to make oil with. So I thought, just in case I run out, I'd better slow down on the oil and smoke. So you don't use nearly as much when you're smoking. So hopefully when this season is over with and I have my crop, I will be able to make more oil and just stick with that.
Ellen, have you ever thought of maybe cranking up your dosage to 2-3 times a day to see what happens?
I have, and I haven't, mostly because I just don't want to be stoned. I know that sounds silly, but and maybe at some point I may do that. But when this works, it works very, very well. Just sometimes you'll get this is with people who take medication as well. You'll get a breakthrough headache no matter what. It's almost like it has to happen, and that occasionally does happen to me too. But I don't take nearly as much migraine medication as I used to.
I'm wondering what would happen if you just took CBD in the daytime.
Yeah, I was thinking of that, too.
I've tried that.
Oh, you have?
And
okay.
Yeah, and it probably helps, but it doesn't seem to do as much as the oil does. When I was in San Francisco, I picked up a couple of a CBD vape pen and some CBD tinctures and different things like that, which are awful. Tinctures in alcohol are horrible to take. They sting your tongue. But But yeah, I think that the CBD, the vape pen that I bought, the CBD vape pen seemed to do more strangely for my arthritis.
Well, that's what I was thinking of, actually, was your arthritis.
Yeah. And it does seem to work quite well for that. And I probably have the vape pen that I have. It had quite a bit of oil in it, so I've got a few months probably left in that.
And you said initially that as a result of taking the oil, you got rid of your IBS.
Yeah, almost. It was, a month or so later, and I thought, oh my goodness, I haven't been sick. I haven't had to run to the bathroom, after dinner. I haven't had to, be careful what I eat for lunch when I'm in town. And that was a real big thing for me. That was quite important. I'm a very, very thin person. So, right now I'm down. I had the flu a couple of times this winter. I'm 94 pounds, which is pretty scary at 5'5".
Yeah.
But anything I can do to keep food and calories inside my body is a good thing. So,
mm-hmm.
But cannabis doesn't make me hungry. I'm the only person I've met that says that, but I've read articles that say some women don't seem to get that effect.
I didn't either.
Okay, so yeah, that's two people now. Well, I can eat. I don't feel nauseous after I eat like I did before, but I don't get hungry. And that was another thing that the stroke took away, was when your tummy growls and you're hungry, I don't get that anymore. Sometimes I'll smell something and think, oh, that smells good, I could eat, but I don't get hungry.
Do you ever go into the chat rooms that you were into earlier when you were talking about getting your new computer and going into the chat rooms? Do you ever go into them and talk about cannabis to others who have similar issues to you?
We have. Now, the site isn't very active anymore, but we do have files and I can't remember what it is they call them. They're just files and files and files of conversations, questions and answers from patient to patient. And there's a fair bit of information on that. I've actually gotten involved, a friend of mine, the fellow that ran that website, he and I became friends, and I actually worked for the website as a moderator for a few years. And we have started, a website for cannabis patients that we're hoping, once we get it out of beta, that might serve the same purpose as the neurological website did. It was with Harvard University, and actually we have one of the doctors from Harvard University who's interested in our site, and he's thinking that he will be coming, not really to work with us, but they want to, because like all doctors, they don't know much,
mm-hmm.
and he thinks it would be good for MGH to be able at least to go in and view what the people and the patients are saying, the reactions and that kind of stuff. So, if we have support from Harvard and Massachusetts General Hospital, I think that it will be good, be good for our patients and good for the whole world, really, I guess, as far as information goes. It was the one thing I found when I started this. There was no one place you could go where you could find information. I was lucky to find the Facebook page that Corey and Janet Sweeney were posting on, so I could watch what they were being asked and the answers that they were giving. But if you happen to get lucky and find an article on it, there was that, but there was no one place that all that stuff was saved. There was no one place where all the research was saved, so that's what we hope to do. And the site is, if anybody wants to look it up, it's Cannatalks, CannaTalks.com. And it's a very simple procedure to register. And there's not a lot on the site now. There's a lot of articles and stuff like that. But our chat room, it's probably about 2 weeks away from going.
I want to ask you what the doctors feel about your progress over the last number of years.
They're all quite amazed. Sadly, my neurologist moved to BC. He's probably out there with you fellas. But so I don't know who my neurologist is now. My last angiogram was, they moved, I guess now I'm supposed to get them every 3 years. So my last angiogram would have been 3 years ago last summer, and they sent me a notice to get another one. And I'd been doing research on what angiograms are as well, and they're not the healthiest thing for anybody to have. So I've decided not to go. And that sounds shocking, but it's not, because it's the same three choices that I would have had if I'd wanted to do something about the coils shifting, mm-hmm. They'll do surgery, they'll, you know, do something else, or we'll leave it alone. And I've decided I'll just leave it alone. In a few years, I'll go back and have the one that's growing checked. But I'm not willing to go through any kind of surgery or anything like that at this point. From the research that I've done, using the cannabis will strengthen the walls of my arteries, which is a good thing. And there's no treatment. Like, they can't give me, if they've given me anti-seizure drugs, they've given me anti-anxiety drugs because they thought I was going to be anxious, not because I was anxious. They just said, here, take these.
Just in case.
Just in case, because everybody else gets anxious or depressed, and they're still waiting for the depression to set in.
Well, get on that, would you?
I'm putting that off until I need it. You know, someday
I need
a rest, then I'll fall into a depression.
I love your attitude, Ellen. Just love it.
Rather than get depressed, I just get kind of frustrated and a little bit pissy at the world. You know, like, I want to do this, you know. I'm mad that I can't, you know, wash all the walls on one day and, you know, that kind of stuff. I've turned into a bit of a fragile thing. I'm supposed to keep my blood pressure down and my heart rate down. Like, I'll never run a marathon. But then again, I've never wanted to run a marathon, so that's lucky. But,
Ellen, given how close you were to death, do you ever think of death?
Not with any fear anymore, no. No, it's, everybody does it. A lot of people have gone before me, and no one's come back to complain, so it must be okay.
Yeah, I'm reminded of an interview we did earlier this week with Callie Blackwell, whose 14-year-old son was taken to hospice.
Yes, I'd listen to that. That was a wonderful show. An amazing kid and an amazing mother.
Yeah, and he wasn't afraid of death. He said it's calming.
Yep. And it kind of is. I mean, I don't look forward to death, but I don't fear death. I fear the dying. I fear being in pain or not being able to communicate or being alone, that kind of thing, the process. But as far as the death itself goes, no, it's not scary at all anymore. Apparently, I did die after the stroke for, you know, briefly. So, you know, wow. I've done that. So
this is your second life.
Yeah.
Ellen, it was wonderful to talk to you. Anything you want to say in conclusion?
Not that I can think of. It's just for people who are interested in trying cannabis and think that it might help them, seek out people who know. Seek out other patients. Your doctors, sadly, at this point, aren't able to answer any questions for you. So people like Corey, you know, any of the provincial groups, and they're out there. There are a lot of knowledgeable people. And, you know, give it a go. See if it helps. It's not going to hurt you if it doesn't help you.
Ellen, it was great to talk to you. I love your attitude. It's fantastic.
Thank you, Ian. It was nice to be here. And thanks, Corey.
Thank you, Ellen, for coming on and doing your thing and letting people know how you're doing and sharing your story.
Thank you. I've been enjoying your show, so keep it up.
Thank you.
Okay.
And we apologize for the hiss on the line. It had nothing to do with our recording equipment. It was a Skype issue. That's it. Another edition of Cannabis Health Radio. Wherever you are in the world, thanks very much for listening.
You've been listening to the Cannabis Health Radio podcast. Visit our website, cannabishealthradio.com, and follow us on Facebook and Twitter.